Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, and welcome to Revolution Radio. Nice to join you, and glad everyone's climbing into the chat room, and our guest is here. We have a very special show tonight, and it ought to be a lot of fun, too. And before I bring her on, I'd like to just welcome Paula Abeliff. I hope that I've said that properly. And welcome to Revolution Radio and our discussion of your great book this evening, and I'm going to give you a live mic. There you are.
Aren't you nice? Well, thank you for having me, and it's actually, I will tell you, it's Abels, and I take no responsibility for how it's pronounced since it is, after all, my husband's name, and it really looks like it should be anything other than Abels, but...
Very good. Very good. And, you know, it's really nice to talk with you in person. I, of course, have heard of you for many years. And I want to, having read your book and looked at the incredible timeline that you sent me, I want to really thank you for everything that you have done up to this point and also for writing this book. And I'm really honored that you would join us this evening.
Well, I appreciate you having me. It's always, you know, it's always wonderful when you, you know, you kind of, I had a show, as some of your listeners may know, on Blog Talk Radio for a number of years, right after the election. And, it, you know, it was always such a treat for me to host. And now to be on the other side, I have to tell you, is almost more exciting. So.
Terrific. Well, I would like to introduce you, but I really don't know anything other than from the jacket and also that we have like an alma mater in common. That's terrific. And I won't ask you to reveal your year if you won't ask me to reveal mine.
That's more than fair.
Okay.
Basically, how I come to this is, really, and this is kind of a little bit about what the book's about, is the book is obviously in the guise of a political thriller, but based, as you know, on actual events that took place during the 2008 election cycle. And it really is a meeting of all these sort of everyday people from all sorts of professions and socioeconomic classes and political points of view and everything else, who come together during this election and really begin to sort of put the pieces of the puzzle together about what happened in the 2008 election and basically how President Okono is elected. Now, I mean, I don't think I have to tell anybody that Okono is a stand-in for Barack Obama, but it kind of shows, I hope it does anyway, through the lens of real people, the political process, how it unfolded, the dramatic impact that it had on their lives, and also recounts, I hope, in a way that is accessible and entertaining some of what happened in the 2008 election, which I hope will be a kind of a cautionary tale for us in 2012 election and elections to come.
Thank you. Thanks very much for that introduction. And again, this incredible timeline shows all of us here, well, I know I was a Clinton supporter and now ex-supporter, but we saw the whole thing, and our lens is from finally wanting to see the entire picture put together. Anyway, I wanted to ask you to just tell this story. Now, you have this timeline. So really a personal, sorry, I'm just handling the switchboard and watching out for certain things. So pardon me for skipping around here while I get back on my agenda.
No, not at all.
Yeah. So it's a real personal effort to get this out, and it's a warning. I heard you say warning because I am struck by the way you, for example, weaved several things into this story of the election of Okono. One is really, from your perspective, the timeline started in about mid-2007, and a lot of financial events were related, it seemed, like collapses and bailouts and so forth, kind of culminating in the fall of 2008. So that whole thread, I know I had a gut feeling that something was going on. Then the other thread of you know, Okono and his support and the various events surrounding deaths and so forth and so on, that thread. And then along with campaign donations, illegal donations, and then the very real thread which you explored of the trashing of Clinton's campaign and so forth. All of those threads are, I think, significant. And could you let me know if I've missed a few threads, or could you elaborate in terms of your story for who are the key players in those threads?
I think for people who are reading it, it's and I hoped that I made this sort of somewhat like real life in the sense that as I was writing this book, certain things became apparent or were exposed that I did not know when I was campaigning for Hillary Clinton. And one of them, for example, is the journalist, where it became apparent that, and I believe it was the Daily Caller who eventually outed them, but it was, 400 sort of self-described left-leaning journalists from all the heavyweight big print television, cable news, even think tanks and blogs. And when I say heavyweights, I want to give your listeners a sense that I'm talking about New York Times, Washington Post, Newsweek, Time, The New Republic, all the news stations, CNN, CBS, MSNBC, NBC, NPR, Sun, Salon, LA Times, New Yorker, all of these. And there were 400 of these people essentially on a Google listserv, and they were comparing notes. And initially it was just supposed to be that they had the same sort of progressive agenda, and they would publish or post articles to kind of get people who had the same sort of political leanings that they did, their impression of their arguments, et cetera. But at some point it devolved, and it literally became a mechanism whereby they were actively shielding working to shield Obama from stories that they felt would be negative, and strategizing how they would respond to stories and what they would do to critics who raise the stories. And one of the things I think that's really shocking to people, for instance, and I'll just give you this, and I don't want to give you too much, I hope your listeners, but one of them is the Reverend Wright story. And the Reverend Wright story comes up, and Daily Caller actually exposes these emails that go back and forth. And one of the people says, well, I'll tell you what, why don't we do this? Why don't we choose a target? And in this particular case, they suggested Fred Barnes or Karl Rove, and we'll call them a racist. And then essentially they won't be able to respond. And then we will say to them, why do you have such a deep-seated problem with a black politician who unites the country? Now, anybody who knows anything about Alinsky style politics, and these are obviously the politics that Obama was schooled in the foundation and various other places, knows that these are absolutely the tactics that he advocated and used with incredible success. But the idea that our so-called objective news media, I mean, most of us recognize that certainly Clinton supporters believe very strongly that the news media was in the tank for Obama. But when you recognize that it wasn't just that their sympathies with it were with Obama, but they were actively colluding to, I think that takes it to a whole nother level. And that's something that, I think that's one of the most important things. I mean, and it still exists. I mean, after journalists basically, the membership dissolved because they got too much attention, then they essentially started something called Cabalist. And as far as we know, it still goes on. And if you look at some of the press stories about Obama when there's a damaging, allegation or revelation, most recently in this thing where Reverend Wright accused him of somebody of the Obama campaign of offering him a bribe to kind of keep silent until after the election, there's this incredible unanimity of response in these big publications. Either they don't respond at all and they don't cover the story, or they quickly move to sort of, cover the story and then, seem as if to say, well, there's nothing here, folks sort of move along. I think knowing that something like that exists for me and for a lot of other Hillary supporters all of a sudden explained a lot of things. I think another aspect of this, another thread that you were talking about, is the one with Marshall Gantz. And in the book, he's identified as the professor, but really who he was, and everything in the book about him is actually, all of it's factually correct. He was a Harvard psychology professor who is probably the foremost world expert on forming organizations and movement building. And one of the things that he told the Obama campaign was basically how to, almost if you hear it, it sounds almost like brainwashing, but how to lure their supporters into a more emotional connection with the candidate so that any criticism of him was repugnant to them. I mean, they just literally couldn't tolerate it. They almost couldn't respond to it in a rational way. And I think that's something that you saw from the Obama supporters. So I think all those things, they came in afterwards and they pull into the story later. And many of the main characters don't even know about that until it's exposed later, or never even learn about it even later. The reader is in the position of the reader is the only one in this book who really has all the pieces of the puzzle.
It is a great book. I hope you saw my blog post.
Aren't you nice?
It really is. I mean, it's a page turner. I just read this thing just, you know, very quickly. Now, this is the thing I want people to really understand. You know, we get talking the fiction here, but there are real life stories here, right? As you said, Reverend Wright, everything was buried. So I gather, are you saying, well, then there was a media fraud, the caucus fraud, which was also not covered by the media, but in addition to all of the things that you exposed, and we'll ask you to expose a few more and maybe describe from some of your characters as well what happens, but are you saying it was the media was the main engine of letting the horse in, of admitting the horse?
The media is definitely one of the main engines, and I don't think anybody who really followed it closely, and then obviously once the revelation of this journalist, I mean, that seems to, you know, be pretty
yeah.
conclusive evidence. But, you know, looking at it, somebody asked me, what was the turning point in the election? In other words, what
right.
made Obama win? In other words, what was this, you know, kind of, and it's interesting because all these things come into play. I mean, for instance, you know, I guess my most honest response to that would be money. I mean, the literally
yep.
untrackable amounts of money that Obama collected, and that's one of the things. You know, if anybody, if you're not interested in reading Admit the Horse for any other reason, just except to educate yourself about how the money works and how what a poor job, unfortunately, of the FEC does of really knowing where the money comes from and how easy it is for somebody who his intention is to game the system for them to do so. So, you know, this staggering amount of money. And, you know, just to give you an idea, I mean, because I know you know, but many of your listeners won't really realize that,
yes.
you know, at the time that we're talking, Obama had raised more than $460 million, which was more than any campaign in history. I mean, really way, I mean George Bush, who was considered to be quite a successful fundraiser, I mean, really hadn't even come close. And finally, the McCain campaign, actually it was the RNC, did actually file suit in October 5th in 2008 with the specific allegation, and very few people know this, that the Obama campaign had accepted money from foreign nationals. And I don't think at that late date they probably had an expectation that it would go anywhere. But what people don't really realize is at least $250 million of that $460 million that he'd raised came from small-dollar donors, which means that they were under the $250 reporting limit, which means no info was available about them at all, not their name, not their address, not their country of origin, nothing. And you know, it's really horrifying when you consider that the entire amount of money that McCain had for the campaign was $85 million because he accepted public financing. So $250 million of Obama's was essentially unrecorded, which is twice the entire amount that McCain had to spend on the election. So, I mean, if anything puts in perspective for people the role that money played in the 2008 election, I hope that that does. And Newsweek ran an article called Goodwill Hunting, which if anybody looks for it on the Internet, please send me a copy because I think it's been scrubbed. I can no longer find it. But it talked about two Palestinian brothers who had contributed more than $20,000 and detailed a number of other abuses. And the way that many of these people had done it was they used these prepaid gift cards. Now, most of the other campaigns, and I don't just mean Clinton's campaign and McCain's campaign, but, you know, John Edwards' campaign and the other people who are running, you know, on the different sides, had something called the AVS system, which is Address Verification System, which means that if you go to contribute money to your favorite political candidate, it immediately matches the amount that you want to donate with your address and make sure that you're not over the $2,300 individual limit for contributing to a candidate. What the Obama campaign did was they turned off that system, which meant that anybody could donate essentially in any amount with no safeguards. And the FEC ended up sending, because somebody asked me about this in the book, because I talk about one of the characters getting a copy of, through a FOIA request, one of, you know, the FEC's printout of their what they considered to be suspicious donations, which they then sent to the Obama campaign and asked them to take action on. And they wrote 26 letters to Obama, none of which were ever answered. And they had basically compiled more than 1,500 pages of questions where there were serious compliance issues, where it was a foreign bank account, a foreign citizen, or it was over the individual limit. And a number, there were a few press outlets that covered it. There was an article in the LA Times, and the New York Post covered it. But that was really it. That was just about it. And I asked, I had Evan Thomas on my radio program, and I asked him, I said, didn't it occur to you, I mean, at one point, the Obama campaign was spending something like $124,000 an hour on their campaign. And I said, didn't it occur to you that they were so awash? I mean, I talk about this in the book. The Obama campaign, and recognize most political campaigns are so so chintzy and so stingy because they have so little money that, you know, if you want to have an extra sign in your front yard or you want to have bumper stickers or you want to do this, you know, they expect you to pay for them. The Obama campaign not only gave all that stuff out willy-nilly, but as I describe in the book, when they actually had to do a debate for one of his first debates that he had with McCain, I was at the University of Mississippi, they built the stage set down to the cup holders so that he had the exact set on which to practice. Now, that kind of money, the money that it takes to build a stage set, is not the kind of money that political campaigns usually have at their disposal. And Evan Thomas was the one who actually talked about this in his book. And I said, didn't you wonder where all this money was coming from? I mean, didn't you think that you had an obligation to make sure that these were real contributions from real people? And, you know, he basically said, you know, we probably did have an obligation. We probably should have done a better job. We didn't really have the resources. And, you know, Evan Thomas and so many of the others were so buoyed by Obama's success that they really didn't have any interest in looking into anything that might have not been on the up and up.
Wow. I mean, and it's like, it's not, you know, 50,000 or even a million. It's like $250
million. $250
million,
right.
You know, and would you say that's probably still going on right now?
Well, I mean, I think the fascinating thing that's happening is one of the things that the FEC noticed, and this is something that I think people who are very concerned about the role of overseas contributions in American elections, which I think, you know, I mean, you remember a few years ago when they were talking about the Chinese contributing to the Clintons and yeah. Various different allegations have been made over the years. And this is something, obviously, that we should take seriously. One of the reasons why they took it particularly seriously in the case of Obama was because many of these donations were in strange money amounts. So, for instance, if I'm going to contribute to your campaign and you're running for Senate, I'm probably going to give you an amount somewhere like $100 or maybe $125, but it's going to be an even money amount. And these money amounts that were contributed to the Obama campaign were in strange money amounts, like $126.39, so $126.39, making it clear to the FEC that there was a currency exchange. Mm-hmm. Now, how compelling you find that? I mean, I will tell you, I find that pretty compelling proof that that
so
came from
happened?
An over.
Did anything happen with the FEC?
One of the things that's really shocking about this, and I think it was shocking for many of the Clinton supporters, and keep in mind that after, you know, somebody asked me, are you still a Democrat? And I said, you know, people are always talking about rhinos. I think I maybe am a dino. I'm a Democrat in name only now. But 3.4, right, 3.4 million Democrats left the Democratic Party when Barack Obama was nominated. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, when you talk to Hillary supporters, you know, it's funny because sometimes it almost sounds like they're survivors of PTSD. You know, they still have these sort of residual symptoms of having participated in a process which was so, you know, contravening to our ideas of a democratic system. And, you know, the Obama people say, well, just get over it. Well, they haven't gotten over it.
No,
and it was something so, It was so deeply destructive to their faith in the democracy and a fair media and a fair process. I mean, I remember when my parents watched the Watergate hearings, you know, and on a little black and white TV, and I don't even remember. I mean, it was little. And but I you know, you hear people say that there was this dramatic shift after Vietnam and after Watergate in people's feelings about government. And I think that this election, for many Clinton supporters, both men and women, represents a very dramatic difference in their perception of the Democratic Party, the democratic process, and certainly in the media, where they are just, you know, they feel now that they were so naive that they really believed that, you know, they could have a good candidate and they could play fair and, you know, fight hard, and that at the end of the day, you know, the better candidate would prevail, or at least, let's say, the more popular candidate would prevail. But without all these contravening influences of money and media and you know, the Democratic Party sort of tipping the scales one way or another. So I don't know. I mean, I think for some of them, I mean, you may disagree, but for so many Clinton supporters, I think this is the 2008 election was almost a seminal event in their lives.
Mm-hmm. I can understand why and how it would. It was an amazing event, and the race baiting and the attack in the blogs. And, you know, I suffered my hand and cough for a little while before I just had to get out of there before my self-esteem was ruined. And, you know, it was really a shock. And it's a dividing line. And I have two things, one going forward, but one going back a little bit. You described, I thought, really eloquently how the election fraud and the money, the foreign money coming in, occurred. And those small kinds of donations and so forth, and what I have heard in subsequent years is sort of repeated billing of those credit cards, et cetera, et cetera. But I wanted to ask, in terms of that scale of its effect, how much were the larger things, like the hedge funds, Bear Stearns hedge funds, the other large financial events, both either linked to, or how did they enhance or distract people's attention away from what Obama was really doing in terms of how he got elected?
Well, you know, obviously the whole framework.
Sorry, what
of Admit the Horse.
Sorry about that.
No. I mean, it's a great question, honestly. The whole framework of Admit the Horse is, you know, based on a political thriller. And so to some degree, you take the events and you sort of shoehorn them within the context. But that said, one of the things that was most, I think, shocking to me when I started to do the timeline was to realize how neatly so many of these political events fit into events that were happening, you know, sort of in the financial arena. And sometimes, you know, people don't, especially people who are paying attention to politics, they don't really, you know, a bank fails here or somebody loses $1 billion there or something like that. It might be something they see on the news and they don't really put it in the context. But if you believe, and certainly many people do believe, and I really can't say whether I do or not. I mean, I think it's one of those things, I mean, we'll probably know in the next couple of years. But if you really do believe you know, people like Cloward and Piven, and those are, they are given fictitious names in the book, but I think many of your listeners may know who I'm talking about. And they were essentially sociologists in at Columbia, New York, Columbia University in the late 70s. And they basically said, look, we're not going to be able to convince the poor to overturn the capitalist system unless we so what we need to do is we need to get them all in the welfare rolls, and it will cause the system to collapse. And we'll tell them, you know, we'll tell the people that are protesting and throwing chairs through windows and doing all this other stuff that they're doing it because of they need better pay or they want health benefits or they want better housing or better transportation. But really, that's not what it's about. It's really about collapsing the capitalist system. And they wrote this very, very famous paper, and it was reprinted and reprinted and reprinted. it and has become required reading for a large number of elites. And just to let people know that this is not an entirely sort of esoteric academic argument, when Rudolf Giuliani took over as mayor of New York, he blamed this strategy for what was taking place in New York City, which had led to their bankruptcy. And he said, you know, there's a really concerted strategy at work here to overturn the capitalist system. Now, I'm sure many people just kind of, ignored that or dismissed that as hyperbole, and maybe it was. But the thing that's fascinating about this is that, and whether you're conspiracy-minded or not, that the people who were advocating, first, everybody getting on the welfare rolls, that didn't work. But then they moved to voter registration, and they moved to start organizations like ACORN and others. They later moved into organizations like unions like SEIU, which is now the largest union in the United States, and gave, just to give you an idea, Obama $25 million in the 2008 election. And they changed their emphasis from originally welfare, then voting, and then they moved to basically low doc loans on mortgages, and they worked with companies like Golden West and many others, which have now become infamous for the uxorious rates that they charged their clients. Now, would organizations like ACORN and others have not realized that somebody who is using as their primary source of income a welfare check or food stamps, that they would not be able to make the payments on these homes, especially as the rates, you know, they're given sort of these low introductory rates, but then like within, I think it's something like 8 months or a year or something, these rates dramatically, you know, reset upwards. Would it not have been clear to them? Would they not have been sufficiently knowledgeable about their clients' economic situation that they would not have realized that they would almost immediately be forced into foreclosure and lose their homes? And then you can make the argument, well, they did it because, you know, they were working hand in glove with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and they were getting 4% on every one of these loans that they wrote for these low-income people. But I think that you could make a case that they were continuing this strategy whereby they really were trying to sink essentially the capitalist system. As I said, I don't know if I could prove it. I don't know if I... I'd want to be called on the carpet for it. It certainly, I hope, makes a great political thriller. But I also think it's food for thought. I mean, it really is food for thought in terms of when you look at the timeline, it's hard to see that there's no relationship between these events.
Oops, sorry about that. I put myself mute, and I was just talking and talking away. pretty amazing. It really is true. Now, I wanted to ask you, because this timeline is so good, and I just, you know, I've been over it several times, just amazing. Like, when did you start putting that together, or were there bits and pieces of paper over the house or something on that?
When you start writing a story like this where there are so many moving parts, and keep in mind, you know, I started writing this right after Obama's inauguration. And so much of the story was still developing in terms of, you know, some of the things I talked about earlier, which, frankly, we simply did not know in, you know, January 2009. We didn't know about journalists. We didn't know about Marshall Gantz. We didn't know a lot about a lot of these other things. And we knew about the caucus fraud, and we knew about some of the other things, but I don't think we really realized we knew that the Obama administration or the Obama campaign had gamed the caucuses. We didn't really know how. We knew based on the numbers that they almost certainly had gamed them, but we didn't really get how they had done it. And so that was really part of the research and the process that I did later. So what I really did was when I started writing this, I thought, you know, I really need a framework in which to write this, because I really so many people have asked me why I didn't write this as a nonfiction book. And it really wasn't anything to do with libel because, you know, the best defense against libel, obviously, is that what you're saying or what you're printing is true. And I don't think there's anything in here. I mean, there's some artistic license here and there. But most, if I give you an event and I give you a number, then that's the actual event and that's the actual number. And you could almost always Google it and find it yourself. But the reason I did it as a nonfiction book was because I had so many friends who were Democrats and independents and who were so excited about, you know, the election of Obama and really felt like this was such an important turning point for our country to have elected an African American, and this they had this perception of Obama as this pure vessel of new politics. And I think on the one hand, I felt this huge amount of anger because there was this huge disconnect between what I had seen, which was the most corrupt and the most dirty and the most, you know, down low, you know, Chicago brass knuckle politics, and their perception of this man as this kind of messiah-like spiritual figure who could barely sully himself with politics. You know, there was no way to kind of reconcile those two pictures. And so when I would talk to people about Obama, and I would say, yeah, but you know, his first three elections, you know how he, you know how he got on the ballot. He you know, basically challenged the nominating petitions of, you know, all the people that were running against him. So he was running unopposed. And then in the, you know, next two elections, he basically had his, you know, political hacks expose the divorce records, sealed divorce records of his opponents. And the reason they were sealed was because the couple had children. So, you know, it was more than just sort of ordinary privacy issues involved, which is pretty low down brass knuckle politics. And when I would say this, it was sort of like, you know, when you're talking to a 3-year-old and they put their fingers in their ears and they start humming, they just couldn't hear it. And so I really thought, if I can write this as a novel and I can just tell these stories and try to tell them in a way that doesn't seem freighted with a lot of emotion and a lot of angst and a lot of anger, but I can just tell these stories and tell what happened to these people. I mean, one of the things that was disturbing for me, I talk about this obviously, is you know, at one point in time, and I organized, and I'm sure everybody knows this because certainly on the internet, but I organized a large group of people who were on a conference call with John McCain. And basically the next day, within hours, you know, four of the liberal logs were calling me a racist and all kinds of stuff, and I was getting death threats at my house, and it was very frightening and scary. And the thing that was disturbing for me was that my family members, who you would think would be appalled at this kind of conduct and would be appalled at anybody who would use that kind of, you know, tactic against, you know, somebody who's a mother, you know, with two small children and, you know, not really a part of political hack or a political partisan, refused to believe that the Obama campaign could have had anything to do with it, in spite of all the just really kind of irrefutable evidence. So part of it was telling my story, I think, to people I knew and people that I cared about, because I really wanted them to understand why I felt such a strong, I guess, animus might be the correct word, towards Obama. But I wanted also to put it out there for people to understand, because I really felt like after the inauguration, that people were, excuse me, almost looking at Obama as if he were this, you know, sort of great leader, Mao Zedong sort of person that it was impossible to criticize. And I thought that people needed to be informed about who he really was. And if I could take an opportunity to tell a story and, you know, put it out there, I mean, tell them about his early lobbying for his developer buddies in the south side of Chicago and how many of those private developers made millions of dollars on federal and state subsidized housing that then they allowed to become slums. And, you know, show them some of these early things. I mean, one of the things that one of the editors who looked at my book, who's a big New York editor, and she said to me, there's a section in here where you talk about that Congressman Okono's wife gets a $95,000 pay raise literally the week that he gets elected to Congress. And she said, that's just unbelievable. You have to take that out. Nobody would believe that, you know, because if that had happened, there would have been a huge hue and cry about it. And I didn't even say anything to her. She sent me an email, and I didn't even say anything to her. I just sent her the link where it showed that Michelle Obama had received a $95,000 pay raise the week that Barack Obama became senator, and there was literally almost no outcry about it, and it never came up as a campaign issue. And one of the other things that she told me was a little bit over the top, and you alluded to a little bit earlier, was the bullying, the cyberbullying that went on of the Clinton supporters on the Daily Kos and some of the other blogs, and even just in the comment sections of newspapers and things like this. And, you know, she said nobody's going to believe that they did that. And I literally had to send her the links to show, you know, these examples where the Obama supporters basically are gloating over the fact that they've chased the Clinton supporters off these various different blogs, and by harassing them, by printing their personal information, by doing all this kind of stuff. So I guess I had this sense that if I put the information out there, and if people were reasonably open to knowing the truth, that then I could in good conscience feel like I had done my part, and that if I had all this information and I didn't share it with people and I didn't tell them what I really believed to be the truth, that I don't know if I really could have been comfortable with myself. And I will tell you, my husband and I struggled about publishing the book. I mean, the book was done a long time before, you know, and the publisher kept saying, you know, are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready? And we were really afraid. I mean, you know, if you've ever lived through a situation where you've received death threats, and you've ever lived through a situation where, you know, you feel like, you know, you're not sure to what degree you may be targeted by, you know, some omniscient power, whether it's a government entity or a political entity or whatever, you know, it's a very frightening thing. And, you know, we talked a little bit about the murders in the book, and with I think one exception, they're all actual murders that actually happened. Now, whether or not, you know, the reader thinks that they are tied into, you know, the rest of what was going on, I guess I try to leave that to them to decide. But in some cases, you know, it's such a, there's such a strong case that they really were political assassinations. I mean, certainly in the case of Bill Gault, who is the is in the book Bill Gault, and he's the chair of the local DNC and one of McCracken's best friends. And in real life, it's based on Bill Gwatney, who was the Arkansas DNC chair, who was sitting in his office one day, 2 weeks before the Democratic National Convention, when a man came in, asked for him by name, and shot him to death, with no motive that is known, no personal connection of any kind between the two men that anybody was ever able to establish. And the only kind of relevant piece of information that anybody really had to contribute was that Gwatney had been getting death threats, as had Stephanie Tubbs Jones and many, many others, because they were threatening the Obama campaign that they were going to lead a floor vote on the floor of the Democratic National Convention, and that they were thinking that they would be able to sway some of the superdelegates. Nobody has ever discovered the motive for the murder. The assassin was later shot to death in a, basically, as when he was in the midst of being apprehended by the Arkansas State Police, state troopers. So there's no story to be had from him, which also I think strikes people as being very tidy. But I think, you know, people look at the circumstances of this, and then a week later, Stephanie Tubbs Jones, who is the inspiration for Miriam Carter in the book, dies of an apparent stroke after meeting with Hillary Clinton supporters. Certainly Hillary Clinton supporters don't think that her death was accidental. I think that in the book, I try not to speculate. I mean, in that case, I make it clear that I believe that she was murdered, but I don't necessarily tell you who I think is doing it.
Right.
Right.
But because, frankly, I don't know. I mean, and that's, I guess that's part of the thing that should be concerning to people. But there are these, you know, there were all kinds of weird things. You know, somebody said to me.
Hello? Oh, she just dropped, folks. She'll be back up just a second. As soon as she realized she's dropped. I'll be right back.
I'm sure that Kate is going to the switchboard and watching for her to call back in or to give her a call, and we'll get her back up here in just a moment. And so let's be patient and hang in here. I'm certainly enjoying the chat tonight with Nancy and Bob and others that have come and gone. This is a great interview, and I hope we can continue to hear this. The handlers are definitely at work, are they not, Bob?
If I ventured in the slipstream between.
Barack Obama has usurped the presidency, and in so doing is now on the fast track to destroy America. Despite Obama's anti-American policies and disdain for the rule of law, there's a more basic and fundamental issue that needs to be addressed. It is the fact that Barack Obama was never constitutionally qualified to be president of the United States because he is not a natural-born citizen as mandated under Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution. Simply put, Obama was not born to American citizen parents. That's parents, plural. He is an unlawful president. Answering the call to defend the Constitution, fellow Americans across the country have joined forces and proudly announced Article 2 Super PAC. Article 2 Super PAC's overall goal is to ensure that citizens and elected officials clearly understand Article 2 and the definitive meaning of natural-born citizen as intended by our founding fathers, thereby working to create a legally binding vetting apparatus which will ensure that all future presidential and vice presidential candidates are constitutionally eligible. We at ART2 Super PAC are raising the needed resources to develop materials to promote our message across the country, assisting with key state ballot challenges, assembling our legal team of constitutional and elections law experts, and so much more. Please do your part to help save America for future generations and help support ART2 Super PAC. You may donate online at www.art2superpac.com. That's ART2superpac.com. Or you may mail a donation to P.O. Box 940661, Simi Valley, California, 93094. We must work together to get our country back on course. We must throw off this ever-tightening noose of tyranny. We must preserve the founding principles upon which this great country was founded. Paid for by Article 2 Super PAC, not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee.
Welcome back.
Hey, there you are.
There you are. Sorry about that. So you were talking about these mysterious deaths and so forth.
Well, I think it's just one of those, things where it really gets, people always ask me, how much of it is real and how much of it is fiction. And I always encourage people to Google things because I think, just like anything else, you're most convinced by things that you find out for yourself. But just going through it, and or anybody who's read the book, the choir director and the choir member really were murdered within 6 weeks of each other, as described in the book. And those are still unsolved. And Larry Sinclair, who famously made the allegations against Obama about his drug use and a homosexual encounter, and is Sinkowski in the book, did claim that Young was his contact in the Obama campaign, just as is explained in the book. And obviously, you know, speculation has been rampant in Chicago for years that Obama's been on the down low, and I frankly, I don't really have an opinion on that. I mean, those rumors are definitely out there. I don't know. I guess I leave that to everybody else to kind of decide for themselves. In the book, there's a Republican congressman in real life. He's Gilchrist in the book. In real life, it's based on Republican congressman from Ohio, Paul Gilmore. Again, another unsolved case. He was the ranking Republican on the House Committee on Financial Services who oversaw Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and, of course, Acorn. And he died exactly as described in the book. He, you know, they found him at the bottom of his apartment or condo stairs with his neck broken. Bill Gwatney, obviously, Bill Gault in the book, based on the Arkansas DNC chair who was assassinated in his office. Miriam Carter in the book is based on Stephanie Tubbs Jones, who... you know, it's she did come from a meeting of Hillary Clinton supporters, as it's described in the book. In this case, obviously, it's McCracken supporters in the book. And she had been receiving death threats. And certainly the timing of her death was very suspicious. And she wasn't very old. She's 58 years old and in great health. So I don't know. I guess I leave that up to the reader to decide how compelling or how conclusive that is, right? I can tell you that most Hillary supporters are not unconvinced that there's a strong evidence. Mm-hmm. And she was calling for a floor vote. That's the other thing to know about both the Arkansas DNC chair and the character Miriam Carter in the book. They both are based on actual characters, and both of those characters were basically challenging the establishment and saying that Obama cannot win in November, and that the caucus states that he had won were unrepresentational, that Hillary had carried the big Democratic, you know, blockbuster states, New York, California, et cetera, and that these wins in these little Western caucus states were not going to help him, were not going to help them in November, and they needed to really seriously consider that. And people forget, but there really was a period of time right before the Democratic National Convention, and people really were starting to have a lot of buyer's remorse about Obama. They really were starting, the Democratic establishment was really, and primarily the superdelegates, were really starting to worry about whether or not he would be able to survive, you know, millions of dollars of campaign ads, you know, television ads, you know, going on with Reverend Wright, you know, spewing his sort of anti-American diatribes, you know, in everybody's living rooms every night. And of course, to the McCain campaign's, I think discredit, they didn't make that a campaign issue at all and never ran it. But the Democrats had no reason to believe that the Republicans wouldn't use that, and that it wouldn't be extremely powerful, which I think probably it would have been.
That was that brings me to the question of all of this money. Do you think that there was any, you know, intentional cooperation between the Republicans and Democrats to make sure Obama made it? Was there any financial payoff?
You mean between the McCain campaign and
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I worked pretty closely with some of the people, not in the top levels of the McCain campaign.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so. I think that McCain was, you know, I think what the Republicans thought about McCain was right from the start, which is that he really wasn't much of a Republican, and that he is somebody, although very well intentioned, although very well although very highly principled, I have enormous respect for him personally as a person and as a leader. I mean, because I think he really is a good man. In fact, he's one of the few people I think that we met in the whole process that we really did think were good people, honorable people. I think that he is so much a creature of this sort of Washington think, and that a lot of the arguments that are made within the Beltway are so persuasive to him because it's kind of all he hears. And so that he really felt like it would be dishonorable to raise the issue of Obama's attending, you know, Jeremiah Wright's church for 24 years and listening to his tapes at Harvard, and all the other very clear evidence that was given to McCain by Hillary Clinton supporters, I can tell you, because we did a lot of the opposition research, that there were very strong ties between the two and had been, and that Obama had just absolutely lied about it. But, you know, McCain had always been the darling of the media, and he was used to that. You know, he really relished his outsider stature as the maverick and you know, the guy who could kind of bring both sides together and bridge both sides. And he really, you know, people forget how powerful, you know, now the Obama campaign and their, you know, surrogates and supporters have thrown around the term racist so much that it's lost a lot of its power. But people forget, I think, in 2008, how extremely explosive that kind of a charge was, how explosive it was to Bill Clinton in South Carolina, where it literally just undid the Clinton campaign for, you know, a month. While they were kind of struggling and shuffling and doing everything to respond to those allegations, how damaging it was to people who were, you know, like myself, but many others who were accused of being racist because they opposed Obama or didn't think he was qualified or various other reasons. And I think McCain was terrified of being called a racist. And it was, you know, at some point, somebody said to him, you know, is it more important for you to win or is it more important for you to kind of have your honor? Because, you know, you can get down and dirty and go after this guy, but then you're always going to be the guy who pulled the plug on the first African-American, you know, presidential hope. Mm. And I don't think it was a conscious thing on their part, although I do think that the people who were high up in the McCain campaign did not serve him well. And certainly I think their disloyalty to Sarah Palin and their completely rewriting history of, you know, kind of her performance in the campaign and the effect that she had on the campaign and the effect that she had with his supporters has been very damaging. Although I will say again, to his credit, he stands up for her. And, you know, when Steve Schmidt and others have attacked her, he has been more muted, I know, than many people would like, but he has not gone along with those attacks at all. He has not countenanced them. And so I don't know. I think McCain was just, he just didn't have the, he just wasn't, you know, these guys fought down and dirty, and it was just as dirty as it could possibly go. And I just don't think McCain had the stomach for it. I just don't think he's the kind of political animal that wants to fight like that. And I think and I will say to his credit, I think Mitt Romney is showing us the sign of somebody who's much more willing to, you know, get in the ring and scrap for it. You know, I think, for instance, his tactic of going to Axelrod's press conference in Boston and heckling him was absolutely brilliant, because this is what the Obama people did at virtually every single Clinton campaign event or fundraiser. I mean, I'm even talking about ones where it was, you know, $500 a plate to get into the room, and they'd have somebody there from, you know, Code Pink, who, you know, it was obvious had not paid their way. You know, stand up and start screaming at her you know, while she was on the stage. And that happened at every single campaign event I attended with Hillary Clinton. And I don't know of one person who attended an event where that didn't happen, where there wasn't some Obama thing. And, you know, Mitt Romney said it. I mean, he was one of the, you know, thank God he was one of the first people who said it. I mean, so many of us cheered when we heard him say, they said, well, what do you think about, you know, your campaign workers all filed out of the office and they went down and heckled David Axelrod so he couldn't speak. And he said, you know, well, at some point what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. And these guys show up at all our events, and so now I guess we can show them we can, you know, play the same game. And that's the fundamental thing. McCain was never willing to get down in the trenches, and I think Romney, and again, to his credit, is willing to do it.
Interesting. Just a couple of things. I know we had the unbelievable impact of the media to change the story with regard to McCain. Bad combination, because of any Trojan horse to have fought, this would have been the one. But we've had a couple of questions in the chat room about the Odinga connection and violation of Logan Act, and whether also the foreign contributions are a violation of the Logan Act or some other act, but mainly the Odinga story and how you feel this fit in, because that, when you read about it, and we did, and I know a lot of bloggers covered it, it was shocking. It was American money that went over there, and he campaigned for this. And so tell us about Odinga and that connection.
Well, I will tell you, I was one of the first people who covered the And this goes back to what I was saying earlier about, you know, you start doing the research on this and you think, this couldn't be. I mean, this is just too strange. Could this really have happened? And, you know, what happened, and the reason why the story didn't get traction, I mean, knowing what I know now about journalists, the reason why the story didn't get traction was because the mainstream media had no intention of covering any story that was damaging to Obama. But one of the reasons we initially thought that the story didn't get any traction was because PolitiFact had actually covered the story, and originally it was that the Obama campaign had given $1 million to Raila Odinga, who was the presidential candidate in Kenya. Now, that was untrue. They actually proved that Obama never did give any money to Raila Odinga, and as far as we know, there was no money that changed hands. But the thing that people should know about the Odinga story, and of course this is a big that I cover in my book, but because this was something that was very dear to my heart. I mean, when I talk about this in the book, I talk about, you know, I sent this to, I basically figured out who the sort of 50, you know, most influential journalists in the United States were. And I copied this report, which was, I don't know, something like, you know, 6 pages, and then with something like 25 pages of footnotes from really reputable sources. I mean, I don't think that blogs are not reputable. I do think they're reputable, but I'm talking about, you know, from the New York Times and the LA Times and the BBC and the CNN or whatever. So theoretically objective, quote unquote, mainstream media sources. And what really came out was, I thought, extremely damning, which was that when Barack Obama was a senator, he made a trip to Kenya, which, you know, is not considered totally out of the realm, because African-American politicians frequently sort of make a victory lap in Africa. But, you know, he had ties, as everyone knows, to the Luo tribe, which was the tribe of his father. And while he was there, he appeared next to the guy, his name is Raila Odinga, who was running for the presidency of Kenya. And he never appeared next to the then president of Kenya. Now, a lot of people would, I think, with good reason, think that this was a violation of Logan Act, because the U.S. government was, I mean, to the degree that we took a position in the election, we were supporting the current president of Kenya. Now, the reason for that, and people should understand this because this, I think, is really important, is Kenya had been very helpful to us in terms of providing us for information about al-Qaeda. And after the terrorist attacks at Dar al-Salaam and at the barracks, they were very helpful in investigating and tracking down the al-Qaeda people who had been responsible. And they had a very clear intent to continue cooperating with the U.S. government. The reason why Raila Odinga should have raised flags for most Americans is because Raila Odinga ran on a platform in which he pledged to discontinue all assistance to the Americans, to that no quote-unquote Muslim brother would be extradited to stand trial for any crime for any reason, and that the same old story again about, you know, the U.S. being the big brother and the bad guy and you know, kind of stand with Muslim Brothers Unite. So the fact that Obama is appearing with this guy at campaign events really should have raised a lot of people's notice. The other thing that should have raised people's notice is that there were astonishing similarities between the campaigns of Barack Obama and Raila Odinga. And one of them is, I think, and I may not be saying this exactly right, but I think it's, you know, change we believe in or something like that. I mean, it was the campaign slogans, the emphasis on small money contributions, having basically like an army of cell phone volunteers who would go and show up at various different events. I mean, these were all things that were, you know, basically like you looked at them and they were like from the Obama playbook. And at one point, and Obama discounted this, but at one point, Odinga had actually claimed that they were related, and that they were, I don't know, cousins or something else. I can't remember what the exact familial relationship was supposed to be, and that they talked all the time. Now, Obama's spokespeople denied that and said that they, you know, only spoke occasionally and this, that, and the other thing. But I don't think there's, you know, there's clear evidence that he campaigned with Odinga. There are many, many campaign pictures of him standing next to Odinga. He later told one of the New York Times journalist Nicholas Kristof that he had actually met with the Kenyan president, but he never did. And the Kenyans were so angry about Obama's visit that they basically complained to the United States government about it. And keep in mind, this is during the tenure of George Bush was the president. So the State Department received a official complaint from the, you know, from Kenya that Obama was interfering in their political process. So I don't know. I mean, to me, that stands out pretty clearly as a violation of the Logan Act. The Logan Act is that a person may not take a position that is contrary to the stated position of the U.S. government. And usually when we're talking about a person, it's usually somebody who's a representative of the government in another role. So, for instance, an elected official or whatever. But just to keep everybody, so everybody, you know, knows, what Raila Odinga does afterwards is there's a disputed election and people will go back and forth about who was more responsible for stuffing ballot boxes, because it appears both of them were. The bottom line is that when Odinga appears to have lost the election, he sends his supporters out, essentially to massacre the opposing tribe, and the opposing tribe, majority of whom were Christians, and they slaughtered, I mean, just the whole-scale slaughtered these people to the degree that the U.S. ambassador described it as ethnic genocide. So this was, I mean, this was not a little minor, you know, tribal conflagration. I mean, this was pretty big stuff. And I think the end result was, you know, 50 of Odinga's opponents were chased into this church, and they were women and children. And I think they set the church, it was a Christian church, and they set it on fire. The thing that should be horrifying for everybody in the that's listening tonight, or anybody who knows anything about this story, is that you can decide whether or not you think that this is important, whether or not you think that, you know, to my mind, either Obama was duped by this guy, or whether Obama was a willing partisan of this guy. I think those are really the only two options. I can tell you that I sent this to George Stephanopoulos, and he told me that the links between Raila Odinga and Barack Obama were too tangential for him to publish it. Now, I would just submit to you and your listeners that if any other candidate, whether it be Hillary Clinton, whether it be John Edwards, or whether it be, you know, you name it, had gone to a foreign country, stood beside the opposition candidate who was preaching, you know, a virulently anti-American message, an anti-Christian message, let me just mention also, and then leads to a slaughter of the opposition when he loses the election, that would not be a campaign point. That would not be something about which even one story were written in the New York Times or the Washington Post or Newsweek or Time. Nothing. I mean, the only press that this story got was in the Canada Free Press. I mean, that this was after I sent it to 50 journalists. So I think that's the first thing. I think was it a violation of the Logan Act? I would say unequivocally from reading the Logan Act, yes. In answer to the other questions, are the campaign donation overseas donations to Obama, is that a violation of the Logan Act? No. Foreign nationals are not allowed to contribute to U.S. elections in any amount. And I can't tell you what exact act that is, but the Logan Act is specifically for, you know, basically what it was designed for. I mean, it comes from various different things, but, you know, Irish politicians had a tendency to go over to the IRA and stand next to the IRA when they were, you know, kind of venting about the British government. And the Brits got mad and said, you know, we're tired of seeing your Irish politicians over here and fomenting all this discontent. And so that is, I don't remember if that's the exact genesis of the Logan Act, but that was one of the primary reasons why it ended up getting a lot of use and where people get threatened by it. The other example, if I can just give people this, and I apologize if I'm going on too long, but another example of where it's pretty clear that Obama almost certainly violated the Logan Act is in a story, and if anybody wants to look this up, it was in the National Review. It was in September 15, 2008, and it was a gentleman by the name of Amir Tahiri. And what he revealed was that Obama had secret negotiations with the Iraqis, and he had vowed that he would extend the military mission in Iraq. And keep in mind, this is while telling all his supporters that he's going to end the Iraqi war and that he's going to pull out and there's going to be, you know, whatever, a six-month timeline or whatever it was. And this is literally in September, so just a few weeks before the election. He has gone to the Iraqi commanders and told them that if he's elected, he's going to be extending the military mission. You know, does somebody who is a U.S. citizen who is not, you know, currently the president, have a right to negotiate with Iraqi commanders, military commanders? I mean, I don't know. I think that would be a clear case of something you're probably not allowed to do. And after, interestingly enough, after Tahiri wrote this article, and of course Tahiri was in support of this because Tahiri did not want the U.S. to pull out of Iraq in a kind of disorganized or an abrupt way. But Tahiri got all manner of death threats, and he even published on his blog something to the effect of, you know, I'm glad that Obama's changed his position, but all you Obama supporters, you can stop giving me death threats and things like that.
Wow. Just amazing. I'm glad you mentioned that. I was going to ask you about Iraq, and thanks for catching up on the Odinga piece. Now, okay, so we have clear evidence here, and there's plenty more to come, I'm sure. But we have clear evidence of at least the media collaborating. Is this a RICO case?
You know, of course, it's so hard to know with the media to what, you know, extent there's sort of, you know, to what degree does cooperation become collusion? And I think that's a question probably for a court to decide. I think it would be, you know, and as people have seen who've tried to bring various different kind of court cases against Obama, it's very difficult to prove standing. So who would have standing, I think, would be a difficult thing to know. I mean, would Hillary Clinton have standing because she would say, well, the press colluded in not portraying her opponent fairly? I don't know. I mean, you know, unfortunately, the press has had such, you know, an incredible ability to not be honest, not be honorable, and yet, you know, so many times their sort of misbehavior appears to be forgotten. And I think the only thing that I would recommend to people is I'm not sure that how much there's we can do to the press and you know, to kind of express our dissatisfaction and disgust, I think, maybe even with the way that they've covered a lot of these issues and not covered these issues, except not to watch them. I mean, I do think that there's something vaguely reaffirming about the fact that, you know, everybody talks about Colbert and Jon Stewart as being these incredibly influential, you know, comedians slash political satirists or whatever it is. And yet you look at their, you know, nightly viewers, number of nightly viewers, and it isn't even close to the people on the other side, the conservatives. And you look at somebody like, you know, I mean, thank God Keith Olbermann's now off the air, but, you know, somebody like Keith Olbermann, and you compare him to the numbers that, you know, say Sean Hannity attracts. And, you know, people are clearly voting with their feet. People are clearly understanding that they're not getting all the news, and they're clearly not getting a factually representational sampling of the news. And I guess I hope that all those people go out of business, because I don't know if there's any way to actually, you know, it feels like there should be a way to prosecute them. But I can tell you, you know, when people print libel about you, one of the things that they tell you is that, you know, they tell you, one, not to pursue them, because it just keeps it, they just keep it on auto drive and they'll keep repeating the charges. The second thing is that they all these newspapers or whatever have insurance, and so they don't really care about how much money they spend. And what is true of libel and pursuing libel is really, I would guess, almost exactly as true of anybody who pursues the media for any factual distortion or you know any of these other kinds of things. There's just almost no way to prosecute them.
Well, and also it's just impossible. There's just no way anything is true. And I guess I would say the difference right now is so many more of us, because all of this has happened and been exposed, are a lot more aware now. Not only are they turning off that media, but turning to other sources where we get the true story. I want to take you back to just a couple of points, one in time from your experience, and then back to the beginning of the story where you discussed the mysterious death of the person who forged the birth certificate. But first, back into time, what happened on the floor? So many of us saw the video and were on top of it and so forth and so on, but was this just finally the end, squeezing Hillary to, you know, call off any floor vote?
Are you talking about the National Convention, or are you talking about the Rules and Bylaws Committee? The National Convention was such a strange thing, I think, for many of us. I think, I didn't really put...
people had died right before this. So
right.
She lost some two really huge supporters who could have made an enormous difference in the outcome of that convention.
The thing that would be... that I think would be fascinating to people who were not there was that... the Clinton supporters, and I will, you know, I certainly knew a lot of them there, and I cannot, you know, ever hope to speak for anybody, and I apologize if I'm putting words in anybody's mouth, but certainly it was my impression from speaking with people that almost all of us felt an enormous sense of menace when we were there, and that people, we were wearing our Clinton paraphernalia, hats, buttons, whatever it was, very proudly but very defiantly, but also with an idea that there may be some safety issues. And I think everybody probably would agree with that. The Clinton supporters, as you probably know, were treated very, very badly at the convention. We had a very difficult time getting floor passes, which is not ordinarily the case. They really just did not want Clinton supporters on the floor. I mean, they really were worried about this. You know, the thing I talk about in the book is, you know, originally the Clinton supporters hear that there isn't going to be a floor vote. And of course, a floor vote is a democratic tradition since, I think it's 1876. There's every single year there's been a roll call of the states. And it's one of the most dramatic parts of the convention. I mean, it's the one they always put in prime time because, you know, it's the one everybody remembers, you know, Madam Speaker, you know, the whatever, proud state of Alabama, cast 13 votes, blah, 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 the whole thing. So first we had heard through the blogosphere that they, the Obama campaign, was determined that there would not be a roll call of the states. And so a number of people went to Howard Dean and said, you know, we've been hearing this, and this better not be the case. And they were very aggravated about it, I mean, as you could imagine. And Howard Dean poo-pooed them and said, you know, where do you all get these ridiculous stories from? You know, you have to stop listening to this stuff on the internet. You know, it's, I mean, you know, I mean, he wouldn't even really credit it with a response. He just seemed to think it was so ridiculous. Well, then no less an authority than the New York Times prints within a week that an Obama spokesperson has said that they do not want a roll call of the states. And then all of a sudden, it was like the consensus flipped. And all of a sudden, then everyone said, well, why would you need a roll call of the state? I mean, this is, you know, sort of like, why, you know, he's won. Why would you have to prove it? And, of course, the thing that the Clinton supporters really wanted to kind of bring to the fore was, well, look, first of all, he hasn't won. I mean, there have been plenty of politicians, including recently Ted Kennedy and with Carter, who literally brought the fight right to the floor of the convention. And nobody thought that Teddy Kennedy was any less of a Democrat, as far as I've ever been able to understand, because he did that. So why the idea that somehow Hillary Clinton wasn't playing fair and being a good Democrat for doing something that Ted Kennedy had done, you know, 15 years before, I don't know, I mean, that was just sort of, people really couldn't kind of put that sort of parallel thinking in train. But they were determined that there would not be a roll call. And I think the reason they were determined is, well, it goes back to what I said a little earlier, was people forget that right before the convention, there was a lot of buyer's remorse. People were, and I talk about this in the book, people were all of a sudden kind of looking at this new shiny boy toy, you know, Obama, and thinking, we don't really know anything about this guy. This guy has appeared from out of nowhere. And then there are certain things that we do know about him now, which we didn't know before, like the Jeremiah Wright story, like stories that were starting to percolate in the National Review about his ties with Bill Ayers, you know, about his early ties with some pretty radical left-leaning groups in Chicago. You know, and there was a lot of stuff that was coming out that seemed a little too radical and a little too scary to a lot of people who were sort of, you know, Clintonian Democrats, who were very much kind of in middle-of-the-road moderate Democrats, who were not comfortable with this black liberation theology and not comfortable with, you know, people meeting with Gaddafi and having, you know, domestic terrorists hanging out at their house and all this other stuff. And, you know, the media did a great job of really, you know, burying that story. But I have to tell you, you had asked me what was the one thing that I wish that I had gotten into the book, which I didn't get into the book. And the one thing that I wish that I had gotten into the book, and I apologize for just taking this little tangential side here, is I wish I had gotten in the Christopher Anderson's revelations that the allegations which had appeared in American Thinker and some of the other conservative blogs that Bill Ayers had had a substantive role in creating Obama's book Dreams from My Father were true. Because, you know, complete blockbuster. I mean, this is the basis of, you know, all these claims that Obama's brilliant. And basically his justification for earning a place at Columbia and Harvard and all these other things, you know, which we've never been able to prove how he got into these schools or why he got into these schools. But it's always been this idea, well, but see, he was such a brilliant writer, which we know because he, you know, later wrote this brilliant autobiography. But, of course, if you didn't write the brilliant autobiography yourself, then that kind of calls all the rest of the pieces of your resume into question. But I think that was what was going on, is that there were all of these things were starting to percolate about Obama, these radical connections that he had. And a lot of the Democrats who were moderates, who were the Stephanie Tubb Jones, who were the Bill Guadagnis, who were the Bill Clintons, were saying, this guy cannot survive a brutal, punishing Republican onslaught. And here are what the ads are going to look like. And here's what the ads are going to say. And we have no defense against them because this guy did this. I mean, you can't think of a Democratic, never mind Republican, you can't think of a Democratic candidate in history that's had the kind of really strange connections and toxic personal and professional associations. And I'm not even talking about Rezko. I mean, Rezko, which is among the most bizarre stories in the book, but, you know, some people kind of lost track of Tony Rezko, but Tony Rezko is a political bagman in Chicago. I'm sure many of your listeners know who he is. He's Joey Ali in the book. But the thing that's fascinating about him is that, you know, he literally spent 3 years in prison before he was sentenced. And 18 months of those 3 years were spent, I think is it 18 months or 8 months? I may be wrong in saying this, were spent in isolation. Well, nobody who's up on RICO charges, you know, I mean, unless they're like a mob boss or something like that, I mean, nobody spends their time in isolation. So, I mean, what was it that Rezko knew? What was it? Why was he so dangerous that nobody could talk to this guy, that he was in isolation? I mean, you know, these are all kinds of questions to answer. So I think that is the bottom line, is that there, if this had gone to a floor vote, I can't promise that... You know, the Obama people had such a lock on the convention. I can't promise that the result could have been any different. I think if Stephanie Tubbs Jones had been alive, I think if Bill Gwatney had been alive, if some of the other people, you know, their death terrified people. I mean, you should understand that, too. People who say, oh, well, I don't find, you know, the evidence persuasive that they were murdered. I perfectly am willing to, you know, concede that that is a perfectly reasonable point of view. But you should also recognize, whether you believe it or not, that plenty of other people did believe it, and it had a very chilling effect on people's willingness to oppose Obama, because whether he did it or not, people were really afraid. And political dissent is much less likely. I mean, somebody's a lot less willing to stand up on national television if they think that something's going to happen to them on the way home, you know, whether there's any justification for that or not.
And it still goes on. And we have just about 5 minutes left, and I wanted to just ask you quickly and then give you the last few minutes. But do you think, you know, we now find out about all these things about Obama, and it still is a muted response and not covered. Do you think that any of this stuff is really starting to bubble and starting to cause concern? Do you think the Democrats are going to dump this guy or are going to try to keep him in?
I think the Democrats will not dump him. I think they will keep him. And I think part of that has to do with the fact that the most likely candidate, or probably the only candidate they're looking at right now who really could have, you know, whose numbers would be significantly different than Obama's, probably would be Hillary Clinton, and I think she has no intention of running. And I hope that that is the case. I hope that her husband wisely keeps her out of this. I think, as far as knowing some of these things about Obama, I will tell you, and I take enormous credit for this, and probably I should not take any, but I have a friend who is a highly placed political operative and works for the Republicans, who told me that 30 of my books had been ordered by the Romney campaign, and I don't know if that's true or not. I have no way to substantiate that at all, but I would love to think that I had some small part in informing them about what they're up against, and maybe give them some idea as to tactics that they will need to employ if they really want to run an effective campaign against this guy. But I think, you know, it's so strange. I think there is information that is starting to come out about Obama. I think there will be more information that will start to come out about Obama. I think many of the people who have been pilloried as nutcases and wingnuts and everything else will be exonerated. And because I think there is so much that is strange about his background, and so much is still coming out, that I think eventually we will look back on the 2008 election and wonder how the American people were hoodwinked into accepting somebody about whom they really knew so little to basically lead the free world. But that said, you know, the next election is really going to hinge on a lot of things like voter ID laws and how successfully they're able to stoke the fires of racial discontent, and how effectively they're able to harass their political opponents. We've seen evidence that they've already started doing those things. They've already promised a really dirty campaign. He doesn't have the money going into it this time, either from overseas or apparently from within the United States. So will that curtail some of his, you know, his activities? You know, to what extent will the unions, after, you know, the debacle in Wisconsin, will they be willing to support him after, you know, he basically tweeted his support for them. You know, is SEIU going to give him another $25 million this time around? I mean, that's hard to know. Those are all things that go into it. But what I would say to all of your listeners is, you know, these are the things that are critical. We didn't really get a chance to talk too much about voter ID laws, but, you know, the photo ID is just essential. And if you realize that, you know, in the state of Florida, between, you know, one of the elections, I think it was 500 votes. In Ohio in 2008, the difference between John McCain and Barack Obama was something like 224,000 votes. There were 200,000 of those registrations which they accepted, which they could not prove came from citizens of Ohio. So just with that, just leave your listeners with that thought. It does make a difference. It is hugely important, and it's something that everybody needs to, you know, whether you can be a poll worker or a poll watcher, or, you know, you write to your congressman and state officials in support of these voter things, and do anything that you can to show your support for photo ID. I think that it really might determine the election.
Thank you very much. Well, we are just really running out of time. I just want to thank you again so much for coming. I find that I would like to sit with you for a long time and talk about this book. And I encourage everyone to buy this book and also give it to your congressman and so forth, because this is really an interesting way to get at it in other ways that we haven't. And there is that tantalizing piece. We here are convinced that Obama is constitutionally ineligible because of his father's citizenship and so forth, notwithstanding wherever he was born. And I wanted to mention and give a plug for your book, because that was very tantalizing. And I hope that you write the subsequent book that tells us what happens with that as we get more information. So, Holly, thank you so much for everything. Thank you for coming. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And I still believe there are some books out from your publisher, Polly, that they're letting us have. So thank you so much again for coming, and look forward to talking with you again.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Take care now.
If I ventured in the slipstream between the viaducts of your dream, where mobile steel rims crack and the ditch in the back road stop, could you find me? Or would you kiss my eyes, laying you down, silence easy to be born again, to be born again. From the far side of the ocean, if I put the wheels in motion, yeah, stand with my arms behind me, yeah, I'm pushing out the door, could you find me? Would you kiss my eyes, lay me down, in silence easy to be born again, to be born again. There you go, standing with the look of avarice, talking to you to let better, showing pictures on the wall, whispering in the halls, I'm pointing a finger at me. There you go, there you go, standing in the sand, darling, with your arms behind you and your boy, finger at me. Look that straight at you. Coming through, darling. Up I ventured in the slipstream between the viaducts of your dream. Where a mobile steel rims crack and the ditch in the back road stop. Could you find me? Would you a kiss on my eyes and lay me down in silent season to be born again? To be born again, to be born again. In another world, darling. In another world. In another time. Got a home on high. Ain't nothing but a stranger in this world. I'm nothing but a stranger in this world. I got a home on high. In another land. So far away. We up in the heaven. We up in the heaven. We up in the heaven. Away! In another time, in another place, in another time, in another place. Another place, another time, another place, another face.